Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with best-selling novelist Terry McMillan. Her novel, Who Asked You?, is just out in paperback. She'll be coming to town for the Essence Music Festival. We'll also hear from Carter Hooper about a very special book project, and Mark Yakich, editor of the New Orleans Review. Terry McMillan is the best-selling writer who's brought us such beloved books as How Stella Got Her Groove Back, Waiting to Exhale, and Getting to Happy. Her most recent novel, Who Asked You?, is new in paperback. She's one of the featured speakers at the Essence Music Festival Empowerment Seminars this coming weekend, and I'm so glad we'll have her in town. Terry McMillan, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you very much.
Now, at the center of this novel, Who Asked You?, is Betty Jean, who is a hardworking woman at the center of all kinds of family relationships. Complicated relationships with her sisters, her husband's not well, her grandkids have come to live with her, her daughter's in trouble, her son wants to move in after he gets out of prison. It seems like she's got a pretty full plate.
I would not want to be her.
Do you subscribe to that notion of you create a character and then you pile on the trouble?
No. There are a lot of people that I know whose lives are very complicated and layered. And you don't just usually have one problem. And in this case, I was more interested in telling a story about grandmothers who end up caring for their grandchildren. And there are about 7 million of them in the United States. And I always found that the notion fascinating, how you end up reliving parenthood when you should be retired and on to something else. And normally, I mean, in real life, from all the research I've done and just from observation, most of these grandparents, their children, it has to do with drugs 99% of the time, or death. And sometimes the death is as a result of drugs. That's part of it. But also, I was interested in what happens when you are an adult and people are always trying to tell you how to live your life, and especially when they don't look at their own.
Yeah. Now, one of the things I love about Who Asked You is the way the story gets told from everybody's point of view. And you're really good at capturing that whole range of viewpoints. I mean, these young boys in this book, these grandkids, really come alive in your work.
Oh, I love Luther and Ricky. I wrote it from 15 different points of view, and it wasn't to quote-unquote show off. It was because it was the only way I could be democratic, and it was important to me to be democratic. You know, you don't often get everybody's viewpoint when something happens to them or that they can respond to. And in this case, you know, a lot of the children who are victims of bad parenting, and especially who often end up in foster care or, in this case, a grandparent coming to their aid, you don't often hear how the children feel about it, you know, what it's like to be uprooted, what it's like to know that one of your parents is a drug addict, and just what they are exposed to and how they respond to it. So I just try to put myself in their shoes.
And like most kids, they're way more observant and insightful about the adults around them than they really are.
Well, you know, I don't think that a lot of these children are unique. I think that that's part of the problem and one of the reasons why I wanted to at least exhibit how they live internally and externally. You know, a lot of times you have really smart parents, and not always smart parents, but for the most part, smart parents, they ask their children, well, what do you think? How do you feel? How does this make you feel? And sometimes their children, and unfortunately no one asks them, but they do have a brain and they do have a mind and they have thoughts and they have opinions. We all do. Cats and puppies have opinions.
Oh, yes, they do.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, and if they could talk, they would tell you, but they have other ways of showing you. And children, I believe, are the same way. I think in some cases, these kids are smarter than the adults.
Probably, in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another thing I love about your characters is that they insist on a rich, full life, along with the hope of having it all. And they live out this complicated dance of duty and desire. I think that's what tugs at a lot of these characters in this book.
Well, I'll put it this way. I think that there's something to be said for people who are victims of all kinds of things. You know, financial woes, health issues, all kinds of things. But I think basically most people want to live a healthy life, an interesting life, one where they are self-sufficient and not dependent on others for their well-being. And I think that a lot of times, you know, I hate to say it like this and sound so crass, but I blame parents. But I think that a lack of education has a lot to do with some of this and what children are exposed to. And sometimes their parents are just basically mimicking what they learned or didn't learn as children. And unfortunately, it passes on. But a lot of people, and you have some people that escape and they fantasize. They know. They watch television. They know what a good life is like. And nowadays, you know, these kids are on the internet. They watch these rappers and people on television and reality shows and all of this. And they look at the really cool cars and big fancy houses that people live in. And some of them aren't really striving for that. They just want to know, can I keep my bedroom clean? Can I get a decent sheet on my bed? You know? And I think in terms of the grandparents in this story, the grandmother in particular, a lot of times what parents do, I think they transfer their desires and fantasies and dreams to their children when they can't fulfill them. And in this case, grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
They try to show them what they didn't get.
So what do you think the secret to Betty Jean's survival is? I mean, she has a hard life. And I would like to mention for the hometown crowd that way back her family has roots in New Orleans. But what is it you think that keeps her going?
I think love. Just pure love. And she's not a weak woman. I mean, my own mother raised 5 children, but all of us are college educated. 2 didn't finish, but we all stepped foot in a college.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're pretty self-sufficient. But my mother, she was determined that her children were not going to end up like some of the people that we knew growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And because we grew up in a small town in Michigan, and most of the people that we knew were poor. They just were, you know, you can say financially challenged, but poor is the appropriate word, because it was in the 50s. And my mother just said, you know, there's no babies going to be born in this house. Everybody in here is going to college or I will kill you.
Whoa, that worked.
She didn't mean it, but, you know, it was enough to put the fear of God in us. And we listened to her. There were no kids in that house. And she had 4 daughters.
A little fear is a good thing sometimes, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Now, one of the things that I really want to make clear to people who are listening is that this is a novel about really serious issues, but it is hilarious. It is so funny.
Well, I believe in humor.
Well, did you laugh when you were writing some of these things?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
Oh, yes. And you have to understand that the humor isn't deliberate. It's really quite organic. I don't try to be funny. And a lot of times, in this case in particular, I try in almost every book I've written to let my characters tell their story and not Terry McMillan jump into it. And I can always tell when I'm trying to be cute, and I have to stop myself. But those kids cracked me up. They really cracked me up. Some of the things that came out of their mouths, and I was a little embarrassed, but I was like, this is what he would say. And then the sisters, you know, the one who I just couldn't stand, Arlene, oh, I could not stand her. But I ultimately ended up liking her, and that too says something.
I couldn't stand her either, but she sure made me laugh. I mean,
yes. And the other sister who was just a dingbat, there's one in every family.
Yes, there is. That's true too. Now, have you been to Essence before? I'm curious.
I've been there twice.
So do you feel like this is a kind of homecoming for you and your fans? Is this something you look forward to?
I'm not sure what to expect, but I'm like so much older now than when I first went. But I like the music, and, you know, I'm not a rock star, a movie star, or a rapper or anything, but I can't just walk around in those crowds. So I will enjoy my first day there, and then at night somebody will escort me to go see Prince. And more than anything, and I hope no one holds this against me, but I can't wait to get some grits and shrimp.
All right.
That's what I'm more interested in doing. I'd rather take the shrimp with grits than see Prince.
Oh, don't tell him that. Well, I'm sure we can fit the bill for those shrimp and grits, I tell you. And a lot of people here think you're a rock star for true. We've been talking with Terry McMillan, whose most recent book is Who Asked You? New in paperback. You can meet her Thursday, July 3rd at 7 at Octavia Books or at this weekend's Essence Festival. Her seminar is Friday, July 4th at 3:55 at the Montreal Convention Center. Check out essence.com for more information. Terry, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Carter Hooper and I are longtime Facebook friends, but this is the first time we're meeting in person. He's in advertising with Hoffman Miller, so you think he'd be clever and cool, and he is all that. But he's also a real sweetheart. Here's what caught my eye on Facebook, a digital book Carter put together called Larry's List, My Dad's Reading List from 1984 to 2005. So, Carter, thanks for coming on The Reading Life to talk about your dad's list.
Thank you, Susan. It's very nice to finally meet you. I didn't even know you were looking at my Facebook page.
Scary,
isn't it? I was thrilled when you
I love this. It's a wonderful record of so many years of reading. So tell us what made you do it, finally.
Well, my dad died in 2005, right before Katrina, and we had to go back up. I'm from originally North Carolina, Greensboro, North Carolina, and so we all had to go up and clear out the house. And my dad had told me that he wrote down all the books he read. He was always reading downstairs, and I just never asked to see anything. But when we were going through his stuff, I found a box with all these cards. There's like, you know, a couple dozen front and back cards that he had hand cut out of old paper or old manila folders and everything like that. And he had listed every single book that he had read starting from about 1984 all the way up to just a couple of months before we had to put him into an assisted living facility. And I didn't actually go through them until a couple of years later. But then I started going through them, and I would look at a couple each night just to see. And I'd try to figure out what I was doing at the time that he was reading the book. And a couple of years ago for Father's Day, I decided to put it all together. It was actually mainly a gift for my sister. And I actually held on to it until it took me about 6 months. I scanned all the cards in front and back. I looked up where you couldn't read his handwriting. I found out which book it was. And then I wrote a little two-piece page about my dad and his reading.
And he got his books in a kind of unusual way, didn't he?
He did. My dad, in addition to being the manager of the Nice restaurant at the Nice department store in Greensboro, North Carolina, he also did a lot of volunteer work with the North Carolina State Prison System. And what he would do is he would establish little libraries, and he'd go around to all the bookstores in Greensboro and Winston-Salem, and they would donate these paperbacks, and all the paperbacks had the covers ripped off of them.
Well, you know, that used to be the way booksellers got credit for returns with mass market paperbacks. They just returned the cover, not the whole book.
You know what? Nathan Hoffman just told me that this morning when he was looking at my book. Yeah, that was very interesting. But we just had big boxes of books with the covers torn off. And he would donate them to prison, but before he'd take them down there, he would let me go through them and pick whatever I wanted.
Well, it's just so charming. The record of his thoughts about these books. I mean, some of them are so brief, but to the point. I really loved that in May 1988, he read William Wright's Lillian Hellman biography, and he said, quite a gal, liked sex and lied a lot.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Did you have any idea what these books were that he was reading? Did he ever talk about
them? Actually, no, because I'd already left home. I'd moved away. I've been down here since like 84, 85. So this actually, he started mainly this after he retired and all the kids moved away from home. And he would sit downstairs. And while he still did the volunteer work with the prison system, he would just read all he wanted to. too, from whatever he
got. It was so interesting. I mean, he read The Maltese Falcon in 1999 and said, don't like murder mysteries, but thought I should read it. Still don't like them.
Yeah.
He was a man of strong opinions.
He was also, he'd read anything, but if it was racy or had stuff, he would always mark it. He goes, lots of sex. And like, he was a little bit prude, but not in real life. But
he read The Women's Room and he read Ruby Fruit Jungle. Those are kind of unexpected books, don't you think, for him to read?
Yeah, but it was basically whatever he got, you know? He would read whatever he got. And I always like going back and seeing the books that I sent him, like Confederacy of Dunces, and he would read it, and he'd always say, gifts from Cart. And I easily liked them.
I know. I think that's so, so sweet. And he read James Lee Burke's Neon Rain and sent it to you, he said.
Yep. I think I actually still have that. But when I was putting this together, I wanted it for the cover. I wanted it perfect. So I actually ordered these old books that he had read from eBay. And then when I got them, I would just rip the cover off.
Oh, you're kidding.
You did? No. It had to be perfect. And it was just for my sister. You know, it's just, well, my dad was such a sweet guy. And it's very private, but there's just something so universally touching about this. And you know, nowadays you just don't write every book you did. I mean, you use Goodreads or even your Amazon orders. You know, that's how people keep up with it. But probably if he'd been from a different generation, he would have done the same thing. But I just love these handwritten.
I know. And the fact that he cut the cards by hand.
He did. He always did that when, you know, he ran the restaurant and he'd bring home old menus. And when I was growing up, that was our scratch paper. And that's what we drew on. And on the blank side of the menus from the garden room at Meyer's department store, he did not waste anything.
Now, what did you learn about him from doing this?
Well, I found out he was a hardcore Democrat, mainly because of the scathing review of Kitty Kelly's Nancy Reagan autobiography, biography. One of the strangest things is toward the end, he wrote these all the way up until about 6 months before he died, actually probably about 8 months. But there's a couple spiritual books there in the end. And, and my dad wasn't really a spiritual guy. He told me one time he just went to church for the covered dish suppers. And the very last book was like Saved by the Light. You know, if he could find any kind of comfort or solace in that, I hope he did. But he'd rather Sidney Sheldon any day.
He did read a lot of Sidney Sheldon, didn't he?
He loved Sidney Sheldon. And it's funny because, you know, those books were full of, you know, off-color stuff.
And he read Silence of the Lambs twice.
Oh, did he?
Yes, I noticed that. That was so interesting to me. And then he had read Daniel Boorstin's The Discoverers. And he said, hope to read it again in 2 years. And so I turned ahead looking to see if he did, but he didn't.
Oh,
but it was kind of sweet, you know? Well, I think I would have loved him. He seems so curious and opinionated, and he says what he thinks. He's just very direct.
And he was a great reader. I mean, he loved his books.
20 years of reading, it's just great.
He probably did even more than that, but that was when he started, like, writing everything down.
Well, it's just magical to look at. We've been talking with Carter Hooper, who's just put together Larry's List, my dad's reading list from 1984 to 2005. You can find it at carterhooper.com/Larry's List, and that's Larry's with the apostrophe. Thank you so much, Carter.
Thank you, Susan, and thank you for letting me talk about my dad.
Poet and novelist Mark Yakich teaches at Loyola University. He's visited The Reading Life before to talk about the poems collected in Unrelated Individuals Forming a Group Waiting to Cross, Green Zone New Orleans, The Importance of Peeling Potatoes in Ukraine, as well as his novel A Meaning for Wife and his nonfiction Checking In, Checking Out. Mark Yakich also edits the New Orleans Review, which is published at Loyola University, and that's what we'll be talking about today. Mark, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Would you tell us a little bit about the history of the New Orleans Review? It has a long and distinguished history.
It does. Miller Williams started New Orleans Review in 1968.
Wow.
He was at Loyola. He was only there for a year or two. And then he handed it off to a number of editors. And over the years, there have been, I want to say, 10, 11, 12. John Biganay was editor, you know, a professor currently at Loyola. Chris Chambers was the most recent editor. It's been joint edited sometimes, co-edited by two people. I took over in 2012, but it has had a storied history. It's one of those mid-tier magazines. It's not the New Yorker, it's not the Paris Review, but it has this really great reputation for publishing new and emerging writers, especially the last 25 years. And then we've really had fun putting the magazine online, a lot of it, in the archives, and my interns, my students, and myself. And we've discovered all these great interviews. Jimmy Stewart, Anais Nin, an early Joyce Carol Oates story, an interview with Joseph Heller. This is one of my favorites. It's called Notes Towards a Second Novel, and it's like from 1971.
Wow.
Right? Because he notoriously didn't publish one until, was the 90s? I mean, his second novel. So there are these great gems in the archive that we're just now getting up as PDFs, and about half of them are online now, too, available.
And the New Orleans Review was the first magazine to publish John Kennedy Toole.
Right, right.
An excerpt from Confederacy.
Confederate Dunces. Josh Russell, some of his work. I can't think of the McSweeney's author right now off the top of my head, but Chris Chambers published one of his first pieces. Came out as McSweeney's a couple of years ago.
And so for you as the editor, do you have this sense of stewardship of something that's been around a long time, is going to go on after you've left? And
yeah, you know, I do. I mean, I've been working in magazines for 20 years, not literary magazines that whole time, but some kind of academic journals or literary magazines since Andrei Codrescu. I worked on Exquisite Corpse back in 1997, 90 to 99, when that was first going online. I made the first website for that. So I've been working on and off with magazines for a long time. And New Orleans Review, I've always, before I got to Loyola in 2007, I always thought that was a great magazine, right? And I do hope I'm carrying on the tradition, especially in terms of what I said earlier, emerging writers. And we mix both, established people who have two or three books, but also you always hope to get that story, those poems by this person who's only had a handful of poems published, and suddenly you found these gems that then you get to showcase to the world.
I know. There's nothing I love more than a great first novel. You know, that thrill of discovery, and it's like, oh, this is it. So what do you hope that your tenure as editor will bring to the NOR? What do you want your stamp to be?
Well, you know, it's a good question. When I took it over only a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, the magazine was doing great in terms of being a beautiful object and publishing good work, but it didn't have that much publicity around it. And the change from print magazine to featuring things on a website really hadn't happened yet. So when I came aboard, one of the first things we did is we made a website that had lots of content. So we now have pieces that are just web features, web-only work that's poetry or fiction or essays or book interviews or interviews with authors or artists, writers. But we also still have the print magazine where we feature excerpts in the print magazine on the site too. So there's this great, you know, mutually beneficial relationship between the website and the print magazine. They've helped each other grow. As I said earlier, take advantage of those archives. There's 46 years, going on 46 years of work. And to make some of these things available for the first time really in 30 or 40 years online, and people can then find out what we're doing now. I think that's one thing that I hope I can bring to us, is transition to getting social media. We have a Twitter account. We have a Facebook account. Doing some of this, getting our good work out there from the past, too.
Oh, but getting those archives up, it's like a gift to readers and to scholars.
It's been super
really
fun. Super fun.
So talk to us about the current issue, which is such an appealing object. You know, we're always going to love books as objects, and journals, too. So describe it first, because it's so attractive.
Sure. It is a square, more or less. I can't remember the trim size exactly.
It's perfect.
6 inches by 6 inches, maybe a little smaller. It's got this very svelte cover. It's satin matte finish, I believe. I'm not sure exactly. And then this creamy inside paper. And it's kind of chunky.
Yes, it is.
It's thick and has this beautiful cover that Nancy Bernardo designed. She's designed all the issues since I've been editor. This is the third issue of mine.
And tell us about the work.
Well, this is the other part of the magazine that I hope I'm bringing from my side, is I've always been into books as objects. The Checking In, Checking Out book that Chris Shaber and I did is this great, small, tactile, strange book where you can flip it around. And magazines, I've always had this history with magazines, but they also feel like miscellanies lots of times. And you can't tell one from another sometimes. I wanted to have New Orleans Review print issues be these objects that people wanted to hold and to want to put on their shelf and keep and not recycle after a year or two. So we want it to be more of a fetish object, and this one hopefully is. The content in this one is, again, something that's a little different. There's only 8 authors. These are all long-form works. So there's nonfiction, there's fiction, there's poetry. The poetry isn't a long series or sequence, meaning it's not just one or two poems by the poet. There's 20 poems by the poet. And I guess my idea there is that there's hardly ever long-form work in literary magazines. For the most part, you don't see 40-page stories or 20 pages of poetry from one author. And that's something I thought we could fill that little niche too. So in this one, which is Winter 2014, we have poems by G.C. Waldrip from a series called Part 4, Infolds and Uninspires. We have a short story, The Long View. We have a series of poems called Wind Map by Corey Zeller. And those poems go on for 20 pages. And it's nice to see that much by an author.
Right. You get a real sense of where they're going and where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking with Mark Yakich, poet, novelist, and editor of the New Orleans Review. New issue is in bookstores now. Many thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Terry McMillan, signs Who Asked You, new in paperback, Thursday, July 3rd at 7 at Octavia Books. Terry McMillan is also one of the authors appearing at this weekend's Essence Festival. Her seminar is Friday, July 4th at 3:55 at the Montreal Convention Center. Check out essence.com for a complete list of speakers appearing at the Montreal Convention Center from Thursday to Sunday. Some of those scheduled to appear include Bishop T.D. Jakes, Ayanla Van Zandt, Reverend Al Sharpton, and Robin Roberts. The Bayou Soul Writers Conference takes place Wednesday, July 2nd at the Courtyard Marriott Downtown Convention Center. Presenters this year include Kander Albury, Wahida Clark, Sheila Goss, Drusilla Mars, Christopher Pearman, and Omar Tyree. For more information and to register, check out bswconference.com. Community Book Center, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, will host the second annual Home Fest July 4th weekend from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day. The schedule includes workshops, discussions, storytelling, children's activities, music, and book signings with local authors Freddie Evans, Denise McConduit, and Dr. Mona Lisa Saloy, along with guest authors Yama Brown, Tashira Simmons, and New York Times bestselling author Wahida Clark. Bonnie Warren signs New Orleans Historic Homes Saturday, July 5th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Nicholas Meiss signs New Orleans Hurricanes from the Start Saturday, July 5th at 3 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, July 6th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Joseph Telushkin signs Rebbe, The Life and Times of Menachem M. Schneerson, Tuesday, July 8th at 6:30 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. It's July, and that means it's time to hunt for the popular children's book character, Waldo, all throughout Uptown New Orleans. The hunt is on through Uptown shops for the entire month. Drop by Octavia Books to pick up a fine Waldo local in New Orleans passport with the names of all the participating businesses. Get the passport stamped for each Waldo you spot, and the first 100 seekers to get their passport stamped or signed at 10 or more sites can bring them back to Octavia Books for prizes. If you collect stamps from 20 or more businesses, you can enter a grand prize drawing at a special Waldo party July 31st at 5 at Octavia Books. Remember, the hunt is on for the entire month of July. Find Waldo. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.